welcome to the CAAV podcast. Today, we're going to be looking at the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act, which gained royal assent last year. Among other changes, the Act made amendments to compulsory purchase legislation in England. I'm here with Rebecca Collins from the CAAV, who is going to guide us through some of the details. So, Rebecca, can you tell us a little bit more about the Act and the sort of changes it brought about?
Yeah, thanks, Olivia. The Levelling Up and Regeneration Act, well, first thing I probably should say is that it encompassed a large array of subjects, from English devolution with the combined county authorities to the power to review RICS governance and pavement licences. But much of the Act concerned development control matters, with some points on compulsory purchase, which is what we're talking about today. Many provisions of the Act are actually still awaiting commencement regulations and so are not yet in force, but they may be gradually phased in. However, we have recently seen many of the provisions relating to compulsory purchase commenced, with some of the amendments to compulsory purchase legislation already in force and others are going to be taking effect at a later date. The amendments to compulsory purchase legislation are a mixture: procedural changes, the scope of powers available to authorities, and changes to the way that compensation is to be assessed in certain circumstances.
Now, you've mentioned a change in the scope of powers. Are these significant changes that will see compulsory acquisition of land in a wider range of scenarios?
The change is to Section 226 of the Town and Country Planning Act, which now includes the term regeneration within it. And it's really designed to provide comfort to local authorities that could exercise powers, that they can use those powers for the purposes of town centre regeneration schemes. That change is already in force and takes effect from the 31st of January this year. Arguably, they probably already had the powers anyway, but I think it's really just a clarification, just so that they can remove any confusion about the point of regeneration.
Okay, and what about procedural changes? What are the changes to procedures that advisers should be aware of?
Well, there are some that are immediate changes that took effect on the 31st of January this year, and so are now in force. So I'll cover those first. There's three of them. The first of these is a requirement for online publicity. And this really sees an amendment to the Acquisition of Land Act 1981. I mean, at the moment, an acquiring authority needs to put details of compulsory purchase by serving notices or advertising details in newspapers. This is a new requirement that runs alongside those existing requirements, where an acquiring authority needs to publish details on what's called a suitable website. And a suitable website doesn't necessarily have to be the acquiring authority's or hosted by the acquiring authority themselves. It could be one of their delivery partners, so perhaps a contractor or a joint venture partner, provided that members of the public could reasonably search for it on the internet and find information about the scheme or project, then that would satisfy that requirement. The changes for online publicity will also need a change to the physical notices that are served, because those physical notices will need to include details of the website address. It is understood that revised forms should be available in the very near future, and we'll be updating members once those become available. The other sort of change, sort of wrapped up within those sections, is that there's the ability for a confirming authority to dispense with a requirement for physical disposition of copies of confirmation of the order where it deems special circumstances would make it impractical. What that really means is it's reflecting the experience of the COVID pandemic, when it really wasn't practical for documents to be made available for public inspection in libraries or similar locations. It's just simply because of the restrictions on people going to public places at that time. So not likely, hopefully, to see that, but it is there as a provision for a confirming authority that they can dispense with the requirement of copies of orders to be made available in libraries if circumstances mean it would be impractical. Then the second change, procedural change, relates to time limits for implementation. And these essentially give the confirming authority, not the acquirer, but the confirming authority, the ability to specify a period that's longer than the operational 3-year time limit for a notice to treat or general vesting declaration to be served. An acquiring authority can set out reasons why a time limit might be needed or they feel it's required in their application, but ultimately it's for the confirming authority to determine whether that would be appropriate or not. We do see longer time limits already in nationally significant infrastructure projects or NSIPs under the Planning Act 2008, and they have a period of up to 5 years to compulsory acquire land. So I think this change really provides greater flexibility for other schemes to have potentially longer periods to be able to deliver projects. And then the third procedural change that takes effect, that took effect immediately on the 31st of this year, 31st of January this year, is the ability for an acquirer to agree with a claimant to vary a vesting date. So where a vesting, general vesting declaration has been served, it's possible for the acquirer to say, that's fine, we don't have to take entry and take possession on that date. They can agree to for a later date. That's quite useful in certain circumstances. I mean, we do see this already with acquirers but there's a lack of flexibility in the current system. And if I was to give an example, it would be something along the lines of where perhaps someone hasn't vacated the property and just needs more time to move out of a property. And if the acquirer doesn't need immediate entry and doesn't need that land or property straight away, they might be quite happy to vary the vesting date to give the claimant more time to move. There are some corresponding changes to that, though, to line up the definition of the relevant valuation date in the Land Compensation Act 1961, where the vesting date has been postponed because the acquiring authority and claimant have agreed to do so. So, as mentioned, those three provisions, those sort of procedural changes, are now in force. But there are other procedural changes that have been commenced, but they take effect later on. There is a new procedure that exists for a public sector acquiring authority to seek a direction to disregard hope value in the assessment of compensation in certain circumstances. That's probably one of the more controversial changes that people have been keeping an eye on, and this takes effect on the 30th of April 2024. There are also new provisions and a revised approach regarding appropriate alternative development, with more emphasis on a claimant needing to apply for a CAD, a Certificate of Appropriate Alternative Development, or CAD for short, to demonstrate that alternative value, development value exists. These changes take effect from the 31st of January 2025, so just under a year away. And once the changes take effect, it will no longer be possible for a claimant to refer the matter to a tribunal to establish alternative development value. Their only real route will be to apply for a CAD. And there are other prospective changes in the Act as well, where the implementation date or changes are less certain, or there's no timetable for them at least yet. And there are changes regarding how objections can be heard. There's changes regarding conditional confirmation. Both of those, we've been told, are anticipated for sometime in 2025, but we wait to see. And then there's less clear timetables for plans to accelerate the DCO process, as well as some powers within the Act to allow the Secretary of State to consolidate compulsory purchase legislation and some common data standards for compulsory purchase.
So you mentioned the controversial element that a public sector acquirer may seek for hope value to be ignored. So in what circumstances can they do this?
Well, I think the first point to note and to be clear on, and you're absolutely right, is that the provisions are limited to a public sector acquiring authority and not any other type of acquirer. So that's the first thing to be clear on. The ability for a public sector acquiring authority to seek such direction is limited to the type of scheme they're wanting to build out, with the land that's to be acquired needing to be put to one of three uses, either affordable housing, educational or health purposes. It could be a blend of those three, but they must include one of them. Now, when the acquirer makes its application, then it's required to make out a statement of commitments that the acquisition will be for those purposes. The authority also needs to demonstrate that the inclusion of hope value, if it were to be included, would compromise the financial viability of the proposed scheme. Now, it's obviously that would be the acquirer making the application. Of course, the decision again falls down to the confirming authority. It's the confirming authority that has to determine whether the order should include the requested direction to limit compensation or not. There are provisions in the Act that additional compensation will be available to a landowner if it was proven that the land was taken and then it wasn't used for the qualifying objectives of either affordable housing, educational or health purposes.
But is it fair that the prospect of development should be ignored? Surely that means that some landowners will get less for their land than it's actually worth.
Well, Olivia, that's a good question, and it's you're not the first person to have asked it. It's an obvious question to raise. The CAV could not comment on the fairness of government policy, of course. However, what we can see is that the need for affordable homes and suitable infrastructure, such as health and educational facilities, is well understood and is the subject of much political debate. All political parties recognise the need for more homes and the supporting infrastructure. So I think what we can say is that much is clear. Now, whether it is right or fair that landowners as claimants should receive less for their land and property impacted by one of these schemes or not, it is a controversial area. I suspect those who need the affordable homes would argue that the wider societal needs should outweigh the individual property owner's interest. It does, though, create inconsistencies with compensation. So you may have a landowner affected by, say, a road scheme who would be entitled to full compensation, which would reflect any hope value. Whereas another landowner, where the compulsory acquisition of land was for, say, affordable housing, would see compensation on a completely different basis. Some in the industry are concerned that this relatively minor and constrained breach in the dam of the principle of equivalence may only be the first step. The question is whether the principles might get broadened to include other types of scheme where the viability could be an issue and the public need is thought to outweigh individual property interests.
Okay, so how do you think the limitations on hope value will be used in practice then?
Well, there's a school of thought that the public sector authorities may not see this as a particularly useful or attractive tool. It may be that in reality we see very little use of authorities applying for these directions. And there's a few reasons why I say this. I would suggest that it is difficult for any acquirer to prove the viability question. There are many costs that go into a scheme, and usually the land and property element only makes up a small proportion of the overall costs. Many people bound around the sort of 10%, but of course it will vary depending on the type of scheme being delivered. It can be very difficult to accurately cost a scheme, with there being so many variables, such as increases in contractor or material costs. So how can an acquirer prove that it is the hope value of the land or property that is the only one factor that is affecting liability? It might be more effort than the perceived reward for many authorities. I think also that public sector authorities often have pressure on resources, with some having limited experience of compulsory purchase and already finding the whole area quite complicated. These additional provisions might be seen by some of them as making things even more complicated than what already exists. And there is a degree where, in order to prove that the hope value is the limiting factor that's affecting the viability of a scheme, an authority is going to need to go and spend money getting valuations done to determine that hope value and then work out whether that element really compromises the delivery of the scheme or not. So I do think that sort of public sector authorities that have a good experience of delivering infrastructure sort of schemes and compulsory purchase, they're likely to also know that when they negotiate with landowners, this can frequently be more cost effective and less risky than trying to acquire through compulsion. Those sort of experienced authorities will know that a landowner that's facing reduced compensation to the principle of equivalence is much more likely to object to a scheme. And then that ties up more resources within the authority and with the risk of public inquiries and then the cost of those as well. There are bound to be some schemes, though, where the prospect of development could inflate compensation such that it threatens the viability of a scheme. But I think these things should really be considered in the round.
Thank you. Now, you also mentioned Certificates of Appropriate Alternative Development, or CADs. Now, are these changes the same as those regarding limitations of hope value?
These changes, they take effect on the 31st of January 2025. They go wider and relate to all types of scheme where compulsory purchase is in play. And the changes see an owner of the property, which they believe has hope value, in that it could get permission for another use and be developed, they really only have two options, as I've mentioned. The first option would be that the landowner applies for planning permission if they get wind of a potential scheme. Now, the benefits of doing that is it can crystallise the planning status of the land and it leaves absolutely no doubt about its value. In practice, though, that can be quite difficult to do, as it may not always be possible for a landowner to be clear-sighted enough or aware enough of a potential CPO scheme coming down the tracks. The usual prompt for applying for planning permission is because the landlord actually wants to progress with the development, or they want to sell the land with the benefit of that planning permission. So the second option is probably more likely and would happen once the prospect of the land possibly being subject to a CPO becomes apparent. And in this instance, the landowner would need to apply to the local authority for a CAD. Now, that application under the sort of changes, that application would have to specify the suggested developments within which the local authority will make its determination. It will no longer be possible for a landowner to make an open application for any form of development. Now, the application could also not ask for a certificate to confirm that there isn't any alternative development either. So you can see that actually that change is restricting the landowners. They can't put in an open application for any development. They need to be a lot more precise. The other change regarding applying for a CAD is that of costs. Under the regime at the moment, the claimant can have cost recovery for applying for a CAD. These will no longer be compensatable, so the claimant will have to foot the bill of any cost of applying. And then the main difference, really, as I've already mentioned, is that the claimant no longer has the route of referring the matter to a tribunal to assess the compensation for appropriate alternative development. They will have to be a CAD in place in order for that value to be assessed.
So in practice, with landowners potentially seeing hope value being disregarded for certain schemes or needing to apply for a CAD in order to demonstrate alternative development, what should they do to protect their interests?
Well, Olivia, as we often say, there is benefit in landowners obtaining early professional advice, particularly if they have knowledge of a potential scheme that might impact their land. That advice can have several benefits to it, one of which is ensuring that land interests are arranged and formalised ahead of any compulsory acquisition to make sure that they get qualifying compensation. But it can also be used to consider whether early action might protect a value. So as mentioned, such actions might include submitting a planning application or finding a developer to work with to take forward a change in use of land and thereby crystallise the value of potential development land where that exists.
Now, you mentioned other prospective changes to compulsory purchase. Do you have any more detail on these?
Yes, within the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act itself, I mentioned that there are a few provisions where there is currently no timetable, and I can outline a little bit more details on those. The first of those, I'd say, is the common data standards for compulsory purchase. There are provisions which have been commenced. They've actually been commenced, the provisions, under Section 187, but essentially they only give enabling powers for the Secretary of State to make regulations that stipulate data standards that might apply to compulsory purchase. So whilst that section has been commenced, we're awaiting secondary legislation before we actually see any practical changes on the ground. While applying more broadly to information contained in documents, these regulations might be particularly pertinent to deal with the requirement for online publication, which I've already mentioned. You know, there is a little bit of a conflict there regarding GDPR and perhaps putting copies of notices on a website for everybody to see. So no immediate changes on this at the moment, but certainly one for our members to keep an eye out for. The second one then is how objections can be heard. Currently, if an offer for an objection to be heard is not replied to, so the prospective claimant just doesn't reply, then a public inquiry is automatically held. That's going to potentially change if the provisions are brought in, whereby the confirming authority will be able to decide if there's only one outstanding objection, for example, and they haven't replied, the confirming authority could decide which procedure it wants to follow. And there's this creation of what's called a representation procedure, which we're waiting secondary legislation to see more detail on, or whether a public inquiry should be held. We have been told this is the secondary legislation is due to be brought forward in 2025, but again, we'll have to wait and see. And then thirdly, one of the changes which I think would be quite useful if it was brought in, again, it's been indicated to be brought in at some point in 2025, is something that's called conditional confirmation. At the moment, when an acquirer applies for an order, they have to make out several tests. They have to demonstrate that it's in the public interest, but they also have to prove that they have the necessary resource to deliver the scheme. Applying for the powers for. Now, those resources will obviously be physical resources in terms of contractor ability and people to do the work, but also funding. That can be a problem at the moment for acquiring authorities because they end up in a catch-22 situation. Often they can't get the funding until they've got the order, and they can't get the order until they've got the funding. So it can cause a problem for some acquiring authority, this test. This ability for conditional confirmation in terms of provisions will allow the confirming authority to give the go-ahead for a project, but only on one once they've been satisfied that the conditions have been met. And so the powers within an order wouldn't actually become operative until a fulfilment notice has been given by the confirming authority. There are some other provisions regarding the Secretary of State being able to make changes to legislation to be able to shorten the period for examining DCOs, which I've mentioned, and also regulations for making non-material changes to DCO. Certainly no timetable on those at the moment, but we know it's something that I think all political parties are interested in speeding up infrastructure. So we suspect to see some action on that, irrespective of the results of any general election. There are also powers within the Act for the Secretary of State to consolidate compulsory purchase legislation. I mean, those that deal with compulsory purchase a lot will know that there are a lot of different legislation out there, and the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act lists the statutes, and it is a long list, which the Secretary of State may amend or consolidate. And to sort of supplement that, really, and possibly the precursor to that work, the Law Commission has already been tasked with reviewing the compulsory purchase legislation with a view to making it more accessible and easier to understand. So the Law Commission might come up with recommendations in terms of modification or consolidation of the CPO legislation anyway. The CAV is one stakeholder that has had an initial meeting with the Law Commission on this subject. And we're anticipating that the Law Commission will be issuing a consultation on some outline proposals once it's completed its initial review.
Brilliant. Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca. There are clearly some significant changes there, and as ever, a lot of devil in the detail. Obviously, the CAAV will keep members updated on any further developments following the Law Commission's review. So members do keep an eye on the website and possibly future podcasts. Rebecca, thank you once again for your time.
Thank you.
And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whatever platform you use. Also, if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by emailing us on enquire@caav.org.uk. That's it for today, so until the next time, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.